Margot and I are eating, or have just finished our Sunday evening supper.
Yeah.
And I noticed that right in front of me are two bottles of food things, and I thought I'd comment on them. One is Durkee's Famous Sauce, and I've eaten Durkee's Famous Sauce, I remember, as a child, and Margot and I have eaten it absolutely all our married life, which is now going on 47 years here, she says. And I really know that I've never seen the Durkee's Famous Sauce where the label said new and improved. Now, I think they've changed the label, but it's never been new and improved. And the other thing is Tabasco pepper sauce. And in fact, I remember Tabasco pepper sauce in its present form with the green band and the red cap. I remember that as a child. I don't think Tabasco has changed not only its formula, but I don't think they've changed its label in just years and years and years, half a century or maybe more. That bottle looks like it did when I was a kid. Ken Burns produced a PBS series, History of Baseball, and one of the points they made in the History of Baseball series, PBS series, was that baseball really was a city game. It started in the cities, although it spread to every nook and corner of the United States, and it was based on the game they claim called BASE, B-A-S-E, which was a British game. In any case, when I was a kid living in Jersey City, we played a game called stickball, and I wonder, in fact, that they still don't play stickball in the city. Now, stickball was really based on, I suppose, baseball or base, and what it was is, for a bat, you had a broom handle or a mop handle, so it was a quite thin, not a regular ball bat. And then for a ball, we used an old tennis ball would be really good, or they sold balls, I suppose, for 10 cents at the five and dime that were made of rubber, pink or grayish white, and sometimes had kind of dimples on them. And the pitch was, they didn't actually pitch the ball, but in fact bounced it. I guess you could say bounce pitched it. The pitcher, the person who pitched the ball, he threw it towards the batter on one bounce, and then the batter got three swipes at it. The home plate typically was a sewer plate in the middle of the street, and then there were three bases, and you'd had as many players as you could round up for a game and, you know, divvy up and play. So it could take, I suppose, any number from somewhere like three or four to, who knows, a dozen on each team. One of the things they used to always say at the beginning of these games, and this was an expression, I'd never heard it before or since, but it was called no chips on windows, no chips on windows. What that meant was, if somebody broke a window playing this game, nobody else was going to chip in money to pay for this broken window. Now, the only thing about this is there was a certain amount of bravura, I think, involved in it, because while I think you could break a window, you know, a house window with one of these balls, you could really wallop a rubber ball with a broom handle. But nobody had any money, so we couldn't have chipped in a nickel on anybody's windows. And in fact, I never saw a window broken, but I know what would have happened. The game would have been called because of broken windows, and all the players would have dispersed back into the tenements.
Quentin said that he had an expression they used, that no chips on windows. Well, I heard that very same expression in Michigan. When I was a girl growing up, we played hopscotch and jump rope, but in addition to that, we also would get into games of baseball with kids in the neighborhood, boys and girls mixed. And we always said that at the beginning of our games, no chips on windows. But one time, I did break a window in our own house. I broke the window. And I confessed to this, and it was all worked out in our family about the whole thing. But I had an aunt who was, we called Aunt Bertie. Her name was Bertha, but for some reason we called her Bertie, B-I-R-D-I-E. And she used to write us letters every year at Christmas. And when we were very small, she always signed them Santa Claus. So the year that I broke the window in the house, I got a letter from Santa Claus telling me that I was in jeopardy of getting any kind of good things other than coal and whips because I had broken a window that year.
P.S. The only two games I can remember girls playing in the street, skip rope and hopscotch, and these were strictly girls' games. I don't think boys played either, although I can remember playing hopscotch, but I'm not sure. I think I was much, much smaller when I played hopscotch. I think a couple of things, I don't know. Certainly there's going to be a certain amount of redundancy on these tapes. We're not doing this in any kind of organized way with a checklist or whatever. But I thought, you know, one thing should be established. I was born March 11, 1929, and Margot was born July 19, 1930. So that gives you a sense of perspective. The other thing is, there's a whole story, and I hope that Margot will develop it at some future time, about relatives in Germany, because, you know, Margot's mother was German, and Bertie, who she talked about, was, of course, a German, and she had written to these people in Europe and so forth, so maybe Margot sometime will develop that story further. I had my first pair of eyeglasses at the age of 37, although my eyes weren't really that bad. And then, of course, slowly over the years, my eyes didn't get better, but it got worse and worse and worse. And I once tried, what do you call it, glasses?
Contacts.
I tried contacts. They just drove me crazy. Now, I tried contacts years ago, maybe possibly the 70s or 80s. I really don't have a good memory of that, but I just couldn't wear them. They just felt like somebody was poking a finger in my eye. And I absolutely couldn't wear them. In any case, I finally went to, I tried bifocals, and they drove me crazy too. You know, so, oh, look here, look there. I couldn't. So I went to reading glasses, which, and this is really neat, glasses I just put on the end of my nose so I could look over my glasses and see what was going on, but then these glasses on the end of my nose, I could read something. So we've been going for years and years now to a doctor in Yakima, and he tests our eyes for all the bilagnia that they do. Well, it's a funny thing. My distance vision got better and better and better, better and better and better. So finally, my distance vision got so good, I went to the state license place, and I said, I want to take an eyeglass, a driver's test without eyeglasses. And sure enough, I passed with flying colors. So I at one time had a driver's license that said you need eyeglasses, and then now I have a driver's test that says I don't need anything. In any case, Margo went to get some sunglasses or something to an eye guy here in town, And I sort of proudly announced to this fellow, I said, gee, I feel really good. I don't need glasses to drive with anymore. My eyes are getting better. He said, oh yeah, that's pre-cataract. We ordered and received today a game called Mancala from the Metropolitan Museum of Art. It's an incredibly ancient game, and Metropolitan Museum of Art claims it's been played for 3,000 years, and it was played by the ancient Egyptians. So, but it's interesting that we're going to play now a game. Why did we order the game? Because we're taking a plane ride, and I thought, well, maybe Ethan and I could play this game or whatever on the airplane. And it's portable. It's this 18-inch wooden board and 48 pieces, and it's foldable and all that business. So I thought it'd be a fun game to play. But it's interesting that this game may be 3,000 or 4,000 years old. It's been, I know, absolutely know, this is true. It's played all over Africa. It's played in the ground, in the dirt, in the market square, and played on boards and all that business. And again, as I said, Metropolitan Museum of Art claims it was played in ancient Egypt, I have no doubt. It's not pure chance either. It's a game of skill and luck, maybe as a lot of games are. But it looks like it might be fun to play. But if you think about, for instance, say, okay, but let me tell you a game that was so big in the 40s that you wouldn't believe. There were clubs and people played it day and night, around the clock, and a canasta. C-A-N-A-S-T-A. Canasta was a big, big card game. And I would be very surprised if one person in 1,000 can tell you how many decks of cards they used or what the point of it was or how you scored. I think probably not. So here we have an ancient board game, maybe 3,000 years old, and a game from the 40s now completely forgotten. The topic is credit cards. Young people today grow up in a world where everyone has credit cards, often 6 or 8 or who knows how many. We, of course, grew up in an age where there were no credit cards. We sat here this afternoon during lunch and tried to figure out when credit cards started. I'm talking about bank credit cards. Margot thinks maybe she first heard about them in 1956. And I think maybe that's when bank credit cards like Visa and MasterCharge were first issued. We are not sure when we had our first bank credit card. We think maybe 1972, which is relatively late to have have something that had been around for years and years and years, but we simply didn't see the need for one. There were, of course, gasoline credit cards like issued by companies like Texaco, and we had a Texaco credit card, I think, possibly going back to, say, 1952, and that's a guess. And, of course, you could have charge accounts at stores, and that was prevalent even, I guess, in the 30s. And they issued, I think, some sort of like a credit card or whatever. But Margo said they had to be settled up every month. I guess why we were so late in getting started with credit cards is we're sort of think economically differently than a lot of people do, and or at least do now. And we didn't see, if we couldn't pay for it, we didn't like to buy it. So the very idea of having a credit card, putting something on the cuff and whatever, was alien to the way we thought about it. Margaret and I were talking about games and the like to continue on what I had talked about earlier. Margot thinks her mother played bridge, and she thinks that maybe she played with her father, so they played, you know, a family would get together and play bridge. I don't remember cards being played much in my home as a kid. Manga was a bridge player in college. I played hearts when I was a little kid, very early. That was the first card game I learned. And then I played single deck, which I always thought was harder than double deck. I played single deck pinochle and when I was, I don't know what, 15, 16, in that range. I had a step-grandfather who married, he was an old German, and he married my mother's mother. He was a pinochle player. And one of my memories is him playing pinochle at a card table with a bunch of his old cronies. And I can still sort of recall some vague image of the sound of his fingernails running across the top of this folding card table, picking up the tricks. Now, our home was always a game place. We always had games. We bought games for the children when they were little, and we played games with them, and we still do, how, you know, as anybody that knows us and has been here at Thanksgiving or Christmas. We always played a lot of games, and we, in fact, bought games to take to Kauai when Ethan and Emma and two of us went there a couple of years ago, and we played games. Mom and I have tried different games, and some we sort of rejected. We tried backgammon, and we didn't care for that much, and we tried cribbage, and we didn't care for cribbage very much either. But we've always been sort of open to various kinds of games.
No.
Recall playing as children was Chinese checkers, which is a game that's still available. It's played with marbles. I think certainly those kind of games spring out of the Depression when people didn't have any money to entertain, and it was a cheap way of passing an evening. I think another thing was puzzles. Margo remembers puzzles being put together in her home from early on, and often there was a card table set up and a puzzle was sort of going and you could walk by and put a piece on it. We did that since living here in Ellensburg ourselves, and it's been rather successful. I remember some puzzles being assembled when I was a kid, but I don't think we were big puzzle players either. I think the other thing, puzzles too, though, were a Depression era way of passing the time for not very much money. P.S., I can't help but point out that the ancient Sumerians were game players, and they found beautiful game boards in Sumerian tombs. And in fact, some people want to date backgammon all the way back to that ancient world in the Mideast. And the Egyptians were great game players. They played games, one of the games they played was Jackals and Hounds, and the Egyptian game boards have been found in the tombs of pharaohs. Finally, we did see one interesting thing once in up on Hadrian's Wall. They found a set of dice, and they were Roman dice. In other words, the Romans used them for gambling. Roman army, I suppose. And what was interesting about the dice is they were loaded. This morning, Margot and I had a bowl of Cheerios for breakfast, and it got us to thinking about what kind of cereals we had when we were young children, and especially in view of the fact that you go into a Safeway or whatever now, and it's just looks like acres and acres of all kinds of cereal. So we came up with a rather similar list of the cereals that we had. So let's see if we can go through them. First was shredded wheat. That's a really old cereal. That goes way back to the late 1800s, I guess. And grape nuts, I think, is another old cereal that goes back, I don't know, maybe possibly to the last century. Then cornflakes, they've been around forever. Wheaties, we didn't eat them, and I didn't eat them much when I was a kid, but Wheaties have been around for a long, long time. In conflict with, or in competition with cornflakes. And what are the other ones?
Rice Krispies,
they've been around for a long time. And that's the list, other than the hot cereals, oatmeal and that kind of thing. So you have really a handful of cereals that we ate as children. I remember, by the way, Cheerios. I rather insisted I could remember when they first came out, and I think maybe Cheerios date from around 1942 or 43, and somehow or other it stuck in my mind that I remember when they came on the market, so even they haven't been around forever. Margo wants to add Post Toasties, which she said was a flaked cereal, dark brown, and she thinks they go back to our childhood. It seems to me to be an easy idea to acquire is that some things, for you, easy idea for young people to acquire, is say, well, some things must be around like forever or relatively. Example of credit cards. Credit cards must be, everybody has them now, everybody has a pocket full of them. They must be just really, really old idea. And obviously they're not. Well, I'll tell you something else that's relatively new and came along in my lifetime, and that's deodorants. You think, well, they always had deodorants. Well, they didn't always have deodorants. And I think deodorants came along in the early war years, as far as I know, maybe, I don't know, 43 or somewhere around there, 42, 44. And the first deodorant, I think, was Mum, M-U-M, which was a thick, creamy, it was a cream. You say, what did people do before underarm deodorants or whatever? And the answer is that, well, they smelled. P.S. I think Paula tells a story about overhearing a conversation. I think she said with between her brother and a friend of his, and the discussion was the topic A between them was the use of a deodorant a manly thing to do, or was that really more of like a feminine thing, and maybe men shouldn't do that? Margo and I watched a program, a documentary on Prohibition, and Prohibition took place, was enacted and effective in 1920 to 1934 when it was repealed. And we really don't have a good sense, I don't have a good sense in any case, of what my parents or Margo's parents, she doesn't either, what their attitude was about Prohibition. Were they for it? Did they think it was a terrible idea? Or was it an important social event in the United States? The first big city to go dry was Detroit. But yet again, apparently it was a strongly Protestant movement, and the foreign elements of the immigrants and immigrant farmers, Germans and the like, Italians, they didn't think Prohibition was worth a darn. So I really don't know. I guess what I'm saying is, here's an important event in the history of the country, and I have no sense of what my folks, or Margo has no sense of what her folks felt about this issue. My memory is I never can remember ever seeing hard liquor around my house. I just can't remember ever seeing a bottle of whiskey. My father drank beer and wine, and I think my mother would take a glass of beer. I don't think she drank very much, but beer and wine, but no whiskey. Well, though, who knows what perceptions my brother or sister has. I thought we should revisit the topic of breakfast, and Mog was going to talk about the two girls and breakfast in our home.
When Cindy was very small, under 2 years old, I'm sure, they recommended that you feed children in those days eggs for breakfast. And so I tried to get her to eat eggs. Anyway, scrambled, boiled, fried, and she would not eat them. She hated eggs. So I took her to the doctor, and she was supposed to be getting some shots, and I believe the shot she was supposed to be getting was typhus. And I said to the doctor in the course of our visit, Cindy will not eat eggs. And he looked at me and he said, what? And I said, she doesn't like eggs. I can't get her to eat eggs. And he said, she's due for a typhus shot today. And I said, that's right. And he said, I want to give her a skin test for an allergy to eggs before we give her the typhus shot. So he injected some serum in her wrist, just under the skin. And I sat there with her in the waiting room while this was working and watched her little arm swell up like a balloon. And he took one look at that arm after the specified time had passed and said, this child should not have any egg-based serum, and don't worry about her eating eggs. So that was the beginning of trying to figure out what do you feed Cindy for breakfast? No eggs. And then Kathy came along, and while Kathy liked eggs and ate eggs, she and Cindy both, as they grew older, decided they did not like regular breakfast. They did not want waffles, pancakes, cereal, eggs, bacon, ham, anything that was smacked of an ordinary breakfast, they did not want to eat it. And I think their favorite breakfasts were leftover pizza and either cake or pie. And that's it.
What role did sugar play in breakfast? Because you're sort of a little, I don't know what the word is, allergic, but you don't like syrups and things in the morning, too early in the morning. Did that play a role in this?
Yeah, Kathy did not like to eat anything with syrup on it, like pancakes or waffles for breakfast, because she said it made her feel funny. And I assumed that it's a huge input of sugar into the system in the early morning. And for some reason or other, neither Kathy nor I can absorb this huge input of sugar all at one time into our system. So neither one of us like either waffles or pancakes for breakfast.
Well, one of my memories is Kathy always making these like toasted cheese sandwiches, and I think she probably in her early lifetime ruined, I suppose, surely a dozen toaster ovens with cheese melting all over the burners and screwing them all up before
I'm sure I must be exaggerating a little bit.
We read in the paper today that Ray Smith, who was an emeritus professor of humanities here at Central, died. He was just a couple of months older than Margot Hartley, the difference between April and July. He was a rather incredible fellow. We wondered, and we didn't know whether Cindy had a classroom. I almost think he did, but I can't remember. But certainly he was the best read man I've ever known. He just read and read and read. He was an incredible and intellectual person. And now he's gone. My mother's sister, Tootsie, everyone called her, lived with my mother's and her sister's aunt, Aunt Liza. She was an old woman. She had been a nurse. And they lived in a really beautiful town called Bloomfield, New Jersey, and it looked to me like they led a really sweet life. But that's a child's opinion. I don't think they ever had much money, and I don't think Tootsie, who commuted to New York City and worked in an insurance company, I don't think she made much money ever in her own lifetime. But I'm sure they lived frugally. But I remember the old home, and it had a piano. It had a breakfast nook, which was something sort of special for me, I thought, as a kid. A Tiffany lamp and really old-fashioned kind of furniture and velvet and all that kind of from years past. And it was quite a treat for me to visit there. I remember at least once, but maybe more often, visiting Tootsie in the summer, and a merry-go-round guy would come around. He had a merry-go-round with little horses on it, iron horses. My guess is the whole merry-go-round was, couldn't have been more than 20 feet wide. And for a few pennies, not much money, you could get on and he would hand crank this merry-go-round to go around and around and around in a circle. I don't remember how he hauled it, but it must have had a little pickup or something. But can you imagine going around with a hand-cranked merry-go-round and of course the children thinking this was a great event, and now they would probably turn their nose up at something like that. It looks to me like this is about the end of the tape, and so I'll end it with